Okay, so cosmology is a very interesting field now. It's a data-driven field. There's a lot of precision measurements that have been made and are being made and will be made over the next decade. So I've been motivated recently to ask the question, is precision data, can it answer any questions that we're interested in, or we as high-energy physicists are interested in? It's interesting in its own right, but there's certain classes of questions we're interested in. And there's a lot of data, and so it's useful to think about real data, making contact with real predictions. And so, if time permits, I'll tell you about two things. The first thing I'll tell you about is probing a string or M-theory scale axion with CMB measurements. This is work done with Patty Fox and Aaron Pierce, which will appear shortly. And in the second half, I'll tell you about some dark questions about dark energy that can be addressed by the precision data, and that's work done with Savas Demopoulos. Okay, so now one of the most interesting questions I think you could ask about the precision data is it possible to probe any general feature or prediction of string theory or M theory? And, well, these are interesting theories, and they make lots of predictions, but it's very possible that we'll never probe any of them directly in the laboratory because the energy scales are well beyond our reach. But the early universe, of course, probes indirectly very large energy scales, and so as usual, we can go to the very early universe and use that as a laboratory and see if there's any features that could be extracted or tested. And so my motivation is to look for some generic, or what might be a generic feature of string theory or M-theory vacua, and ask if that feature could be tested by the precision data. Well, one generic feature is in supersymmetric vacua that there are moduli. Supersymmetry breaking lifts the moduli, but depending on the precise manner in which supersymmetry is broken, it's possible that compact components of moduli can remain unlifted. So if they appear directly in the superpotential that breaks supersymmetry, generally that's not the case, but one can imagine that that's possible. It's also possible that these compact moduli transform inhomogeneously under transformations of the vacuum angle for some gauge groups. So if that's the case, then the Pecci-Quinn symmetry is realized in the Nambu-Goldstone mode. So these compact moduli are Nambu-Goldstone bosons, on which a theta angle for some field, for some gauge groups depends, such as the QCD gauge group. And if that's the case, then this gives a natural way to realize the PQ mechanism, to Pecci-Quinn mechanism, to solve the strong CP problem. Because the potential generated as a function of a QCD vacuum angle naturally, if due to infrared QCD effects alone, has minima at CP conserving points. And so if the QCD vacuum angle is actually a field, in other words, the vacuum angle shifts inhomogeneously under transformations of these compact moduli, then the vacuum can relax to a CP conserving point. So that's the Pecci-Quinn mechanism. Now, in order for this to apply, the potential, the leading potential for these moduli have to come from QCD effects and not from other non-perturbative or Suzy breaking effects. So that's just an assumption I'll make. This is a widely discussed possibility, and I'm not going to discuss models how to realize this. I'm just going to discuss whether the precision data can probe such a scenario.
You assume that the Pecci-Quinn symmetry is exact,
apart from the anomaly? Yeah, as I said, right. If the Pecci-Quinn mechanism is going to work, then the leading contribution to the potential for this modulus has to be coming from QCD effects. So that's an assumption. And of course, that's not realized in all scenarios you can imagine. If all the moduli are stabilized in the supersymmetric limit, then there aren't any massless moduli after supersymmetry breaking.
Then the axion is massless.
Well, it depends on the scenario for supersymmetry breaking. Okay, so it's not an absolutely completely generic prediction of all string vacua, but it's a possibility. Something has to solve the strong CP problem. It's probably not a massless up cork. String theory gives you these, it has all the right ingredients, so it's a, I think it's a useful thing to consider.
You solve the strong CP problem and have an axiom which is not massless, right?
Oh, in the end, from the QCD effects, of course, it picks up a small mass. Okay. Yeah. So I thought you meant before.
No.
Before, okay. Yeah. So it has a standard invisible axion-like mass. Okay. So now what's the decay constant? What's the natural decay constant to consider? Well, the one piece of indirect evidence we have for high energy scales is gauge coupling unification, and that's most naturally realized from four-dimensional renormalization group effects. So the unification scale of 10 to the 16 GeV is a natural scale for some fundamental scale, or a natural guess for a fundamental scale. And so we're going to focus on this scale as a relevant scale. In principle, you know, with large extra dimensions or warped compactifications, one might have all kinds of scenarios. But using the at least indirect evidence of supersymmetric gauge coupling unification, it points to this scale. One can ask what the decay constant is if physics remains four-dimensional up to such a scale. And for example, for the string, for the model-independent string axion, which is of this type, all the QCD vacuum angle shifts under transformations of the compact component of the dilaton supermultiplet, the axion. You can ask what the, you can work out what the decay constant is, and for the model-independent axion, it turns out to be alpha over 4 pi times the four-dimensional Planck mass, which is also coincidentally very close to 10 to the 16 GeV.
You're thinking about a specific string theory, right?
I'm thinking about what I said, that physics remains four-dimensional up to the unification scale. And then one can imagine compactifications.
But, Doug, I think this calculation is in heterodic.
That's right.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. This
theories could be different.
Not for the model-independent axion. It's always this related to the gauge coupling in that way.
It is not the case in type 1.
Well, we can talk about that afterwards. And in a M3 compactification where there's some 11-dimensional limit, then it could be slight, for example, in Hrabowitz, the scale could be slightly, the unification scale could be slightly less. And then if you picked a compact modulus that would result in that type of compactification, it might be slightly less, but not a lot less. So for this talk, I'm going to focus on Pecci-Quinn scales of order 10 to the 16 with this motivation. And in the end, of course, the results can be generalized to any Pecci-Quinn scale, but I'll just think, to focus attention, I'll just think of these very high scales as natural scales that might arise in large classes of string compactifications. Now, if the decay constant, if the Pecci-Quinn scale really is this large, then you'll never see such an axion directly in the laboratory. You won't produce it and detect it in the laboratory. Note that it's almost, the couplings are suppressed by 1 over F, they're derivative couplings, so it's even subgravitational strength. Even if such an axion made up all the dark matter, it's so weakly interacting that it'll probably never be detected directly in the laboratory either. So there's probably no way to probe such a thing directly.
Isn't that scale ruled out?
Oh, well, that's what the talk's about. Yeah, we'll see. Okay, so again, so what I'm going to address is how well the precision measurements can probe such a thing. Now, what I want to do is I want to answer that question in a way that's as independent as possible about cosmological assumptions. Because, of course, one can come up with a particular scenario for what the initial misalignment angle might be, as we'll discuss, or how much dilution there is, and so forth, and rule out that scenario. But then there might be some other corner of initial conditions or something that's not excluded. So I want to see how well such a thing can be probed independent of any assumptions. And as we'll see, the important assumptions are the initial misalignment angle, how much of the dark matter is actually made up of axions, and possible entropy releases after the relic axions are formed.
Are you going to talk about cosmic strain?
I can mention that in the end, yeah.
But there's a controversy over where most of the dark matter is.
Well, I can answer that in the, at the end and put the controversy to rest. Okay, so typically one has to make assumptions about this. For example, you could consider scenarios where all the CDM is axions and then see, given that constraint, what the region of parameter space you have to be in and so forth. I want to see what can be answered independent of any assumptions. So let me just remind you the mechanism for producing axions cosmologically. So this was first worked out for invisible axions by Fischler and Dine and other people. So in the assumption that this modulus solves the PQ, or solves the strong CP problem by the PQ mechanism, then the potential for the vacuum angle where the axion is temperature dependent, so at temperatures well above the QCD scale, the potential is exponentially small, coming only from dilute instanton effects. And at temperatures well below the QCD scale, it gets some potential from infrared QCD effects. So since the potential is vanishingly small at early times, there's nothing that prefers any particular value of the initial angle, misalignment angle. So for example, it could be some generic angle. And in fact, if there's an early phase of inflation with random initial conditions for everything, including this modulus before inflation, then there are inflationary patches somewhere that access all possible values of the initial misalignment angle. So if that's the case, then when as the temperature becomes of order the QCD scale, the axion finds itself in a potential, and it wants to evolve to the minimum, so it begins to roll. And so so that leaves some relic density of axions. Gradients in the axion field are redshifted before this epoch, and so the momentum of the axion when they're formed is very low. So they form essentially just the zero momentum part is the part that doesn't get redshifted away. So they form a zero momentum, essentially zero momentum condensate, and so they act as cold dark matter. So they're good candidates for dark matter in that sense. And when you put all the numbers together, I won't reproduce the standard calculation. Numerically, the relic density relative to critical density, little h is the Hubble constant in units of 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So numerically, it comes out to be 10 to the 16 as a canonical number. It depends on the initial misalignment angle. Ignoring anharmonic effects, it goes like theta squared. And then important for subsequent discussion, if there's any RMS fluctuations initially in the initial misalignment angle, those also contribute in addition to the zero mode. Now we know from the precision measurements, or the precision fits to the global fits to all the data from the WMAP team, that in a lambda CDM cosmology, the CDM density is about 0.1 in these units with about a 10% error. And so at most, the axions might make up all the cold dark matter, or in principle, they might make up only a small fraction. So the upper limit on the axion relic density is given by the measured value of the cold dark matter density. And clearly, the relic density is inconsistent for a generic initial misalignment angle if F is of order 10 to the 16. And the average initial misalignment angle is, and the square of that is pi squared over 3. And so for that average value, one could turn it around and ask, well, what F is allowed, what decay constant is allowed? And F has to be, for this average initial misalignment angle, F has to be bigger than about 10 to the 11 GeV. Sorry, smaller.
What is the by square root?
That's the average value of theta squared on the interval minus pi to pi. Sorry. This is slightly different than the canonical number that's quoted in the old literature that Willie found a long time ago of 10 to the 12 GeV, and that's because when Willie did the calculation many years ago, the bound on omega h squared was just less than 1, and so that's what they use. But now, since we essentially have a good measure of this, this is about an order of magnitude smaller, and so really the preferred value, if you like, the modern preferred value is not 10 to the 12, it's 10 to the 11. And just as an aside, the cavity experiments that search for relic axions are based on the old 10 to the 12 number. And so, well, they're looking in the wrong place. It could, but it's okay. Okay, so this 10 to the 16 value that I'd like to think about from this underlying microscopic motivation is clearly inconsistent with this average misalignment angle. And so how can you accommodate, since this is what I want to think about, how is it possible to accommodate a decay constant of order 10 to the 16 GeV?
Sorry, one question.
Yes.
In these units, what is the lower bound on F so that it's invisible?
The lower bound?
Yeah.
You mean from astrophysical constraints?
No, just the invisibility of the axion.
You mean in the laboratory? Or, well, from the laboratory, it's probably really quite low, maybe a few TeV. But of course, there are astrophysical constraints that move that up to 10 to the 10 GeV, and particularly the cooling rate from the from 87A. Yeah, it's 10 to the 10, right. So, yeah.
There's something about this formula that I don't understand.
Yes.
Which is, we know in any inflationary model, omega total is going to be equal to 1.
Okay.
And this number can obviously, for some values of F, be greater than 1.
Yes. Oh, you're asking what? In what if? Suppose this.
Suppose F was equal to 10 to the 16th, and the vacuum angle.
Right.
The vacuum misalignment was. Positive.
Okay, so you can read off from this equation. It means that at a given temperature, the Hubble constant's different. That's what's different. As you say, omega total is 1 in all inflationary patches. But if there's more dark matter, the universe expands faster. So the relationship between Hubble constant and temperature changes.
I see. Okay.
So I can't do the scaling in my head in real time, but it would mean at a given temperature the Hubble constant's different, or vice versa.
Well, maybe h squared is really the actual density.
Yeah. Yes. This calculation would still be correct. It's just that now h would be much different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
So I'm not supposed to plug the canonical value of h into that.
That's right, for the other
for
places.
The other
yeah.
scenario.
Right. Okay. Or for the people that are unfortunate enough or whatever to live in whatever large theta. Okay. Okay, so since this is what I want to focus on, I first have to have in mind how you can accommodate such a thing. So this has, of course, been discussed in the literature extensively. Well, first is the initial misalignment angle could just be small. So we could be, well, lucky or unlucky, as it turns out. And our inflationary patch, or the initial misalignment angle averaged over our universe, doesn't have to be the average value. It could just be very small. For F of 10 to the 16, how small does it have to be? It's about 3 times 10 to the minus 3. Well, I don't have anything to say about whether this is natural or not. Linde has discussed a possible selection effect for small theta. He points out that the density of collapsed objects, like holding everything fixed, so say F is some large number, the density of collapsed objects like galaxies actually grows at some very high power of theta. So if you're unlucky enough to live out here at a generic point, then you would live in objects that are very dense. Presumably the density of stars is very large. And he argues that perhaps there can't be any observers there because that's very dangerous. You get hit by a nearby supernova and so forth. I'm not going to make any assumptions about what's natural or not. I come back to the question. I want to ask whether the precision measurements can probe this thing for any assumptions. Okay. Another possibility.
Assumption three. You didn't make assumption three.
I'm about to. Yeah, I'm not. In the end, I'm not going to make any assumptions.
But, in that first question.
This was for no late entropy release. Okay. And another way you could accommodate it is by dilution by late decay. So that could dilute the axion condensate after it forms, and then if the, for example, from the late decay of a heavy particle, that can reheat the thermal plasma without affecting the axion density and then dilute the axions.
How late is late?
First, since the potential is formed at a temperature of about lambda QCD, the decay has to come after a temperature of order lambda QCD. And so, in principle, then, with a very low reheat temperature, you could dilute the initial axion or relic axions by some arbitrarily large amount. Before I discuss the numbers, let me just say that this scenario is actually perhaps likely in the scenario that the axion comes from a string modulus, and that's because it has, therefore, a supersymmetric partner, so let's call it the saxion. It gains a mass mainly from supersymmetry breaking. So this would be the dilaton in the model-independent axion case. It has some mass that depends on the scenario for supersymmetry breaking. So in different scenarios, either hidden sector or gauge mediated or so forth, there could be a wide range of masses here. The decay rate scales like the third power of the mass, but it turns out when you plug in the numbers, if this has a mass of order TeV that it might have in a hidden sector supersymmetry breaking scenario, for this F of 10 to the 16, you get reheat temperatures that are in fact lower than the oscillation temperature of lambda QCD. And so built into a supersymmetric axion is this natural mechanism to at least give some dilution. Now again, I don't want to build models and scenarios about what the precise mass is and what the decay rate is. That even depends on what channels are available and so forth. I just want to see if the whole possible parameter space can be probed.
But certainly it has to happen before nucleosynthesis?
Okay, so that's the point. So the when you work it out, the factor by which the axion condensate can be diluted is roughly, I'll give you a precise number, but the scaling is, here it is, it's the reheat temperature of the decay over the oscillation temperature, which is basically lambda QCD. So for an arbitrarily low reheat temperature, you could dilute it as much as you want, but there's a limit on how low the reheat temperature can be, and that comes from nucleosynthesis. So what's the bound? Well, from nucleosynthesis, we know the ratio of heavy elements like helium, and in particular, the neutron to proton ratio is fixed at a temperature of about 1 MeV. That's when the weak interactions drop out of equilibrium. And so at that time, the ratio of protons to neutrons is just fixed by their mass difference. And that basically determines the helium abundance. And so if you had a reheat temperature much less than an MeV, that would affect the neutron to proton ratio, and that would affect the helium abundance. And it turns out when you look at just the helium abundance, the bound is about an MeV. However, you can get a much stronger bound for a late decaying particle like the saxion. The reason is, even if the reheat temperature, say, was a little bit bigger than an MeV, well, as the temperature goes down, there's exponentially few left, but there aren't many baryons around anyway. So these very heavy particles that, say, if the mass range is in the order of a TeV, which is what you want for this dilution scenario, the exponentially small number of them around, even at a temperature of 100 keV when nucleosynthesis goes on, is enough to destroy heavy nuclei that are produced. And so although it doesn't affect the total neutron-proton ratio, it does affect details of heavy elements, like lithium and deuterium, for example. Deuterium is very easy to break up. And so when one does a full simulation, including this exponential decay, this exponential tail, the real bound turns out to be bigger than about 6 MeV. Okay, so that's the limit, basically 6 MeV over lambda QCD for how much they can be diluted. So there's a limit to how much dilution can occur. And when one puts all the numbers in fact, for the generic misalignment angle for 10 to the 16, it's not quite enough. And in fact, one needs, even in this case of 6 MeV reheat temperature, the initial misalignment angle, it helps about an order of magnitude in the angle. So it still needs to be smaller than about 3 times 10 to the minus 2. So it could just be that, there is some dilution, and we're lucky, we're not quite as lucky as we had to be. We thought we had to be without dilution, but it still can't accommodate a generic misalignment angle.
And what is the accommodate?
Okay, so that, for the generic misalignment angle, that's 2 times 10 to the 14 GeV. And again, these may be slightly different than older numbers in the literature from a number of effects, getting old prefactors and being very careful about those, and this also much different than most thought. Okay, so to accommodate such an axiom, we have to have at least some combination of these two things in mind, some dilution and or some small initial misalignment angle. All right, so that just focuses our attention on what the parameter space is. Now, is there any way to probe the axion, given that we're in such a scenario, there's some dilution in theta small? Well, the problem is that there's always some small theta that's small enough in which the density of relic axions is vanishingly small, and then there's no observable effects. So can one put a lower limit? So in order to be able to say anything definite, one needs a lower limit on the average initial misalignment angle. If there was some way indirectly to obtain a lower limit, then that would put a lower limit on how many relic axions are produced, and then on their observational effects, which I'll come to in a minute. Well, okay, so there is a way, in principle, to put a lower limit on the value of the initial average value, mean value squared of the initial misalignment angle. If there's an early phase of inflation, then De Sitter fluctuations give fluctuations to all fields that are massless during inflation, and so that would include the axion, since its potential vanishes at high temperature, essentially vanishes at high temperature. And the value is, magnitude is the inflationary scale over the Pecci-Quinn scale. So that's the fluctuations induced in the initial misalignment angle. And that then gives for a given H inflation, that gives basically a lower limit. Even if you're completely unlucky, or lucky, however you want to look at it, so that the average initial misalignment angle in our universe exactly vanishes, there's still some mean square fluctuations produced during inflation. That gives a lower limit to... during inflation, yes. And I think that's a good assumption. Well, I'll come to the other scenario where there's not at the end, if you like. I can discuss that possibility. But
there's
for these... Yes?
During inflation, some combination of fields are not at their vacuum.
Yes.
It could be that there's a potential for the axion that doesn't exist at the vacuum.
Right. So one could consider that possibility, but it's a rather very specialized thing, because in particular the light quarks, assuming that quarks exist, if they're massless, in other words, if electroweak symmetry is not broken, then there's no matter what else you do, there's no potential for the axion, at least from QCD effects. See, if you're going to do that, you need the potential that you generate during inflation to line up with the minimum of the zero temperature potential. And the only way to naturally do that is to have it come from QCD effects. And in order to get a big potential, then you need the light quarks to be, well, not so light. You need to be heavy. So they need to be something of order.
You're saying in that case, there won't be any De Sitter fluctuations, but there will be a big misalignment then.
Yes, if you just have from some other source a potential that comes from some other sector, say that you could couple the inflaton sector directly to the PQ sector and generate a big potential during inflation, but unless you tune the minimum to be where the zero temperature minimum is, that wouldn't accomplish anything. Now, you know, there's some small out. You could imagine that electroweak symmetry is broken by a lot for some reason. And the lambda QCD is also larger. So you could come up with a very Baroque scenario, I think. But right, so that's one tiny loophole, perhaps, to all this discussion. Okay, so is there any way, so modulo that tiny loophole, is there any way to establish what H inflation is by some measurement? Well, all massless fields undergo de Sitter fluctuations, including the graviton. And so there's some relic fluctuations in the graviton that also depend on H inflation. So their magnitude is set by H inflation over M Planck. Well, how can you observe these? These give rise to, these are tensor perturbations of the metric, and so they give rise to polarization in the microwave background with non-zero tensor structure. And of course, one of the goals of future experiments is to make precision measurements of the polarization. Polarization's already been observed by WMAP. It doesn't have a tensor component, though. It just has a scalar component. And the Planck satellite will make high precision measurements. I'll tell you the numbers in a second, which will look for tensor contributions in the CMB polarization. The convenient way to parameterize this is by the ratio of tensor to scalar power in the CMB. So this is usually called R. And at the moment, it's only bounded to be something less than 1 of order 1 by WMAP. It's not much of a bound, but if we saturated this bound, we could calculate for f of 10 to the 16 what the fluctuations would be. And so from this bound, that tells us that they're at most 10 to the 5 times 10 to the minus 3. The Planck satellite, if we have improved polarimeters, will get down to the 10 to the minus 2 level. So that helps by an order of magnitude in the initial misalignment angle. And there's a foreground lensing limit. Just lensing by foreground galaxies and large density fluctuations actually can induce a tensor component just from the scalar components. It's a second order effect, and people have thought carefully about what that limit is. So some hypothetical experiment that can be do as good as possible, there's some background limit, and that's about 1 times 10 to the minus 4.
As f becomes larger, this...
Well, this is for a... Yes, that's right. And so just to present you some numbers, I'm always going to fix this. And in the end, one can make exclusion plots and so forth. But I think it's better to pick a particular f and see what the numbers look like. So if in any of these experiments, tensor modes were ever observed and interpreted as coming from inflation for a given f, that would establish what the fluctuations in the initial misalignment angle would be. And then that would establish, again for a given f, what the minimum value of the relic axion density is. Now, what can we do with this? Well, we could just require that the relic axion density not be larger than the CDM density. That we can do that. I won't bother to write the numbers down. You don't learn too much from that. But we can do a lot better. And the reason is because there are two distinctive features of relic axions which show up in the CMB, and one can either look for them, and if they're not there, get bounds on them. So let me tell you about those. So the first is isocurvature components. Now, what's isocurvature? Well, when the axion fluctuates, its potential during inflation basically vanishes, so it's not really a fluctuation in the background curvature. It's just it's a fluctuation in the initial misalignment angle. So these fluctuations, at least for superhorizon size, what are later superhorizon sizes, don't correspond to real density fluctuations, but they do correspond to fluctuations in the number density of the axion condensate once it's formed. So that's what an isocurvature fluctuation is. This is as opposed or contrasted with a adiabatic fluctuation, such it would come from the inflaton. The actual potential during inflation can fluctuate. So those are real perturbations in the background curvature. Those are adiabatic. And the contribution of isocurvature and adiabatic are much different than the CMB. Let me show you a picture.
Yeah,
Yeah, I'll do that. So this is obtained running CMB fast for either pure adiabatic or pure isocurvature initial fluctuations. The main thing to observe is that the adiabatic, well, it looks quite like the data, as you'll recognize from remembering what the data looks like. And so one thing we know already is that the the temperature fluctuations arise mostly from adiabatic fluctuations. And then by making a precise fit to the data, one can obtain a bound on how much component of isocurvature there is. One thing to remember from this plot, I'll explain it in a second, is that the isocurvature contributions fall off rather rapidly at large L. And so they only give a big effect at small L. That'll be important later when I discuss how much the bounds will improve. So first off, we know that already that temperature fluctuations coming, say, all from the axion or any isocurvature source don't fit the data very well at all. But the question is then, what is the bound? Well, let me just tell you why they fall off so rapidly at large L compared with adiabatic. It turns out, I'll just describe it, this condition of not changing the energy density, well, at very early times when the universe is radiation dominated, then it only takes a small change in the temperature to compensate the change in the axion density after the axion condensates formed. Later, in the matter-dominated era, it's just some fixed balance between the axion fluctuations and the rest of the cold, dark matter and baryons. And as you go to higher L, eventually you see back to regions that were radiation-dominated. And so just the initial temperature fluctuations, because of this effect, are smaller. And so that's why the isocurvature drops off so fast. So only small L are useful. So what are the numbers? So it's useful to parameterize. There's some parameter like alpha, which is the power in the CMB in isocurvature versus adiabatic fluctuations. And from WMAP, this bound isn't very good yet. I'll say why in a minute. It's only about 0.04. And so that corresponds to a, delta theta. An average value of delta theta of less than 1 times 10 to the minus 4. And this is in the case when I assume that the that there are as few relic axions as possible. Namely, that they've been diluted by the maximum possible amount, namely, it's a late decay of a saxion with a reheat temperature of 6 MeV. That's the maximum possible dilution. And that the initial misalignment angle is actually much smaller than the variance. So that minimizes the number of relic axions. It might be worse, and you might say in likelihood it might be worse, but this sort of gives the minimum value. Okay? So for that extreme scenario, this is the value of the fluctuation. This bound is obtained by marginalizing over lots of parameters. One can change the tilt of the isocurvature and adiabatic spectrum. And when you do that, the analysis actually that was done actually included rather extreme values of the isocurvature tilt. In this case, the tilt depends on how much H inflation changes over a couple of E foldings. It's not likely, actually, therefore, to be much different than 1. And we estimate that if one redid the analysis, you can improve this by a factor of a few, even given current data. Eventually, from Planck, most of these degeneracies, like what the tilt is and so forth, will be very well measured at higher L. So that even though the data is only good at low L, and the WMAP measurements are actually already cosmic variance limited out to L of, I think, around 200 or so, maybe somebody remembers. And so it's not that the new data will improve specifically for the isocurvature, it's that it'll remove degeneracies that exist now in the current data. That's right, yes. And so so it turns out tensor also contributes down at low L, and getting a good bound on the tensor will remove that degeneracy and so forth. So lots of things have been marginalized over to get this rather crude number. But eventually Planck will reduce that by almost two orders of magnitude. And so here the number is 5 times 10 to the minus 5. And well, okay, so that's what isocurvature will teach us. The second characteristic signature of axions in the CMB is that they give rise to non-Gaussian fluctuations. That's because the axion density is proportional to theta squared, which is the average value plus the fluctuations. So there's just some average constant piece. It's the initial misalignment angle that's Gaussian distributed by de Sitter fluctuations. And so this next to leading piece has a Gaussian distributed fluctuation. But this is a product of Gaussians. And so it's a chi-squared distribution. And so it's non-Gaussian. Okay, so although it's tiny, it's second order, it is there at some level. So this turns out to be quite a good bound at present. How can one test for the non-Gaussianity? Well, it turns out that the shifted chi-squared distribution, basically it comes from the fact that no matter how theta fluctuates, the distribution of rho is one-sided. The fluctuations in rho can't get less than zero, so they're one-sided, so it's an odd distribution. And so one could test this by looking at odd moments in the temperature correlations. So simplest thing to look at is the skewness. So the simplest odd correlator you could look at is the three-point function. And I've just made it non-dimensional such that if the real CMB was sort of highly non-Gaussian, this skewness would be of some parameter of order 1. And so as much as it's small compared to 1 is some measure of how Gaussian it is. And the bound from WMAP is about 0.06 on the skewness parameter. I should say that this is just the average value. There's some spectrum. It's called the bispectrum because it depends on two relative angles, not just one for the two-point function. And there's some structure in the bispectrum. And in general, one might try to look for structure, and you could do slightly better than just this average value of skewness averaged over the whole sky. However, since the axion contribution, the isocurvature contribution, drops so rapidly at large L, all the structure would be out at large L, and you wouldn't really gain much beyond this. So a full analysis wouldn't change the numbers much, extracting the maximal possible information out of the spectrum of, or the L and L prime dependence out of this three-point function. So in any case, the number here is about 8 times 10 to the minus 5. So that's the maximum allowed value in this smallest possible initial misalignment angle and largest possible dilution scenario. So I haven't made any assumptions. I've just pushed the model into the part of parameter space where it makes the minimal possible impact on the observations. In general, for other parts of parameter space, it would be even worse. Now, notice that this is slightly better than the current bound from the isocurvature, but this, it turns out, won't improve much at all with new data, and again, just for the reason that the isocurvature contributions drop at large L so rapidly that obtaining, and the fact that the measurements are already cosmic variance limited out to L of a few hundred, more and more precise data will not help with the skewness parameter. There's really no degeneracy or anything or uncertainty in the cosmological model. It's basically just a measure of the skewness in the temperature fluctuation spectrum. So eventually, so for now, the non-Gaussian bound is the best bound slightly, but eventually the bound on isocurvature component will be better. So now we can compare these numbers. So let's suppose, for example, that tensor modes were observed by the MAP satellite. Remember, that's a scenario in which we can say anything. If tensor modes aren't observed, H inflation could, in principle, be some arbitrarily low number, and there's some little sliver of parameter space then that you might live in. But the idea was to see what we can rule out without any assumptions. So here, that would say that the fluctuations are 5 times 10 to the minus 4, That's even if it's just at the limit of what Planck could see. But note that that's already larger than the current bounds, either from isocurvature or from the non-Gaussianity. So that means that if the Planck satellite observes tensor modes, that would rule out, without any assumptions, aside from these little tiny loopholes, maybe scenarios that we talked about, an axion with a decay constant of 10 to the 16.
Because I come back to what I said,
I'll address that in a minute. But this is in the scenario when the axion was there during inflation. And I will do the other one in a second.
These bounds on the isocurvature, yes, Gaussian fluctuation, however, do go away if there's a potential for the axion during inflation. That goes away at the end of inflation. But there are no axion fluctuations.
That's true, yes. Okay. That would be true.
Then you have this problem that you have a large
that's
misalignment.
That's right. So, yeah, so that in itself wouldn't help with these large decay constants, but that's a good point, yeah. Yes? Well, not at lowest order, because at lowest order in the fluctuations, they're non-interacting. At second order, of course, everything's coupled. But.
Yeah, but I mean, if you take the normalization out, small scale,
well, that oh that all that goes in all that goes into obtaining these bounds, yeah.
Okay, that's where it comes from.
I mean, it's basically, roughly, it's taking those two curves, it's taking the isocurvature and multiplying it by some factor to move it down, and then seeing how well that, you know, what the, there's some residual left over, okay, compared with the data. Now, one can just do a general analysis in all of decay constant space, if you like. And it turns out that if Planck sees tensor modes, then an F up to about 10 to the 20 is probed or ruled out. So it's quite a strong limit. And again, beyond this, you're not in a, even if you wanted to saturate this, you're not in a generic part of parameter space. You're in this little sliver where you just happen to have small initial misalignment angle. If it's not seen down to a limit, of course, that means that it's lower and lower, and then one could accommodate an F of, if it was only seen, say, at this limit by some hypothetical experiment, a few times 10 to the 18. Right, so originally I had in mind that there would be some interesting range of parameter space left over where we hadn't seen anything yet, tensor modes could be observed, and maybe isocurvature would be seen, and that would be consistent with some interesting value of F. But it looks like the best utility of these considerations is basically to rule out the axion if tensor modes are observed. Okay, so that's the result. So the axion can be very well probed by precision data from the CMB and give us much better information than we had previous through the existence of precision data. And now, so that was all in a scenario in which was relevant to my original motivation for a string scale axion, that the axion actually existed during inflation and therefore picked up some fluctuations. As Willie mentioned, there's another possible scenario that we leave aside string theory and we can just build a model that does the following, that the PQ scale is less than the inflationary scale during inflation. And so one can imagine that there's then a phase transition, like there is for the electric weak phase transition or the chiral symmetry breaking transition, which only takes place at temperatures or equivalently Hubble constant during inflation, less than of order whatever the PQ scale is. So during inflation, the order parameter for the that ends up being the axion is unbroken. So you're in some unbroken phase, and then only after inflation does the temperature fall to a point where the vacuum goes into the broken PQ phase. OK, Okay, so in that case, the discussions I said don't apply, but there's a problem here now, following. So what happens? So let's assume after inflation there's some phase transition that gives rise to an axion. Well, then by the Kibble mechanism, just by causality in a region of order the size of the Hubble constant at the time that the phase transition takes place, things can't be, the initial angle for the axion can't be correlated over sizes much larger than horizon size, just by causality. So that means in one region of, let me just draw it like this, so there's some theta initial here, there's a different theta initial in the next horizon area over and so forth. And so then as time goes on, the horizon expands, and eventually then, even within one horizon size, you access all possible initial misalignment angles. So in this scenario, there's no such thing as small initial misalignment angles. You get them all. And so, if you just want to look in the decay constant space, that's perfectly okay. So from the previous discussion, that might look like the maximum F then is of order 10 to the 11 GeV. However, there's yet another effect, and that is that since the vacuum angle is a periodic variable that lives on S1, well, its first homotopy group is non-zero, and so there are axion strings. In other words, there are, just by chance, there will be curves that one can draw through some of these initial angles in the uncorrelated Hubble volumes, such that the integral of d theta is some multiple of 2 pi, so that means that there's a string, or vortex, if you like, global vortex made out of the axion, and so there are axion strings formed in addition to just the condensate. The axion strings they flop around, they can reconnect, and they reach a scaling distribution in which the scale size is something of order the Hubble scale, instantaneous Hubble scale. So they don't make a, so they're not necessarily bad as far as the energy density stored in the strings isn't necessarily large, as long as F is small compared to the Planck scale. So that's not bad. But as they're flopping around, they also radiate axion. So you get additional axion radiation in addition to what's produced by the zero momentum condensate. And if you look back in the old literature, there are claims that this increases the amount in the total amount of relic density between anywhere from 10 to a factor of 100. And that would then reduce F to between 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 9 GeV. But now this overlaps the astrophysical bounds. And so just from the axion string radiation, this complete all values of F are then, there's no window left for the axion in that scenario. Although it's not published in the literature, I think there's actually an even more a worse bound than the radiation from the strings, which I won't take time to describe, that would further kill this possible scenario. So the conclusion is that if tensor modes are ever seen by any experiment, basically all the reasonable values of F are then eliminated, well, which is unfortunate. There's not much left that could be seen. It would be some really large F, and it would be some little, you know, pipe and parameter initial misalignment angle space, and so you'd be very lucky. Okay, so there was a positive answer. There's something that can be probed very well by precision data, independent of any assumptions. And I think in interest of time, I won't discuss the second subject, but people can talk about it with me privately about looking for signatures of dark matter in precision measurements.
Any more questions?
Well, just to get it straight,
yeah.
There's nothing stinky about the discussion. All you're taking,
that was just the motivation for the initial decay constant. Yeah. See, originally when we did the back of the envelope numbers, it looked like that was just barely ruled out, and something a little bit bigger than 10 to the 16 might give an interesting signal. So,
just about this FDQ less than 18.
Yes.
I wanted to understand better. I mean, it means what the day? I mean, because this can be actually one of the realizations, right? FDQ is 10 to the 11.
One can write a model, yes.
Is 10 to the 15.
Yes.
So, but that I have to interpret this as the Hawking temperature during during inflation.
Yeah. So the point is, even
you want to identify H with the temperature.
That's right. That's right.
Which is the Hawking temperature.
Right.
Because the actual temperature.
Yeah, that's what I meant by yeah. So I use temperature.
So
yeah.
You use the Hawking temperature as something to kill the.
Right. To put it into the unbroken phase. Yeah. Exactly. No, sorry. This is the phase transition that just gives rise to the axion itself. So just imagine some Mexican hat potential.
Yeah, I mean, it will kill the symmetry gradient.
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah.
When does most of the axion radiated by strings occur?
Well, it actually turns out that it's equally important the whole way back. So it's sort of not all, well, let's see. I'm sorry, I've forgotten how it scales, so I better not say.
Because you could imagine if it was produced early,
yes,
it would be diluted by dumping entropy way before it does anything dangerous.
Yes, I don't know the answer to that, yeah. I can just mention the other bound, which is independent of how much stuff the axions radiate. And that is that eventually, so let's look at, so here's two strings coming, say, in and out of the board. And at temperatures less than the QCD scale, then the axion potential turns on. So now there's a potential for the axion fields that live outside these strings. And so that means that, so let me just draw the potential. So as a function of theta, well, I'm just going to redraw the same thing, there's some preferred value. Okay. So that means that the field everywhere wants to fall down to zero, but there's some topological obstruction as you go around the string. And so what that is a domain wall that's attached to the string. And actually, the number of domain walls depends on the anomaly coefficient for the axion. And if the anomaly coefficient, so that's the coefficient of so this is some quantized number. It's quantized because it's related to an anomaly. And so there's some number of domain walls attached to each string. And so in the literature, it's claimed that, well, that's OK. Suppose, let's do the simplest case of n equals 1. That means that every string can find an anti-string and, in principle, annihilate. But I believe that there's probably a causality limit such that the rate at which these things go towards each other is, of course, the annihilation is, of course, bounded by causality. And so I think that once one is left with is some scaling distribution of these strings attached to domain wall, where there's of order one string and one domain wall per horizon volume, just by causality. Now, that's hard to prove in principle. It could be addressed in numerical simulations. But if that's the case, then since there's a domain wall, it quickly dominates the energy density. And so this would completely rule out this whole possibility with strings. Sorry, Willie.
Okay, let's thank Sean.